It was a BBC Studios production.
Things about living in Bedford.
The river.
Grammar school.
Paula Radcliffe.
It's quite nice down the river.
I moved here in 1981 and it was cheap.
Everybody loves the river.
There's a lot of diversity going on.
Nice bit of local history and such like. But,
the Panacea Society.
John Bunyan.
The river. Everybody knows about the airship.
Absolutely massive.
You can't miss it when it's up.
I think the good thing about Bedford is that people want to stay here.
The river.
Mark Steele's in town.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And welcome to Mark Steele's in Town, which this week comes from Bedford. A town that's had such an enormous impact on British society that when I told people I was doing a show here, three quarters of them said, what, you're doing it from a van? But people here are aware of it. I asked on Twitter if anyone from Bedford could tell me what was here, and someone wrote, we've got a prison full of people from Luton. The genius of this town is that even people who live here can't really say where it is. Because if someone says, is it in the Midlands? The answer is not really. Well, is it in the South? Not really. East Anglia? Not really. Is it on the North Australian coast? Well, sort of, but not really. This is true. I looked up the AA directions to get here and it just says potter about and you'll stumble across it eventually. There are some mentions of Bedford on the internet. I found this description on TripAdvisor from someone who once lived here. A snooty public school obsessed middle-class white ghetto. I hated every minute of it. They're snooty about Luton and wish they live in St Albans. They join the Rotary Club and cheat on their wives. The best thing about it is you can catch the late Thames Link train back from London and not worry about falling asleep as it's the end of the line. But in fact, it's much, much prettier than I thought it would be. You come here and you think, oh, it's going to be a little place. The highlight's probably the Quick Fit or something like that. But you get in and think, blimey, I didn't realise there was all this. They've got a river and everything. And you've got these lovely stone bridges over the river. And what you all seem very proud of is the new bridge. That's been lovingly designed to fit in with the older ones. And expense has been spared, with the bill coming in at £8.95 from B&Q for a length of plaster. The brilliant thing about it, when it was built, it didn't even cross the whole river. Hang on, it's 3 foot short, we'll have to jump the last bit. This is all in keeping with the tasteful development known as Riverside North, described by one of your residents when he came up to me in the high street. It honestly happened. Just ran across the street. I hope you mention the achievements of Riverside North in this programme, in winning the Kim Jong Un Award for North Korean-style architecture. You don't seem to want to sell yourself in a big way here. You like that no one knows about the place. There's a book I got that's just there called Bedford by the River, a local book to promote the town, and it said, Bedford is a minor tourist centre with no cathedral, castle or colleges to attract visitors. The surrounding countryside is flat and somewhat uninteresting, but the river has potential that's not been exploited. That must bring in the crowds, mustn't it? But there must be something else here, Bedford, because so many prominent characters are associated with the town. There's a statue of Trevor Huddleston, the anti-apartheid activist and a proud son of Bedford, because he lived here until he was five. The Bedfordshire News tells us Bedford's Carol Vorderman represents our town on I'm a Celebrity. And she is from Bedford because her biography says Carol was born in Bedford, but her parents separated 3 weeks after her birth and her mother moved her to North Wales. Ronnie Barker is on a list of famous people from Bedford, as he was born here, and there's a plaque, so you can definitely claim him, as he lived here right up until he was four. And then there's the one that almost everyone will tell you. You know Glenn Miller, the band leader? This is where he did his last performance before being killed in a plane crash. All the other towns he performed in, when he left, he arrived at the next place safely. But not Bedford. So there's a statue and everything. According to the investigation, the crash was caused by a confusion with air traffic control, apparently, because they asked the pilot what area the plane was in. And the Bedfordshire People Past and Present website boasts another figure connected to Bedford is Terry Waite. Blimey, when Bedford people leave here, they want to make sure, don't they? Now, one of the first things that I was told when someone took me through the town centre was there aren't any of the major stores here because, I quote, Milton Keynes swipes all the big shops. Swipes them. So, like, was there a John Lewis here to start with? But one morning you all come into town and went, oh, not again. How are we going to fill that space now? We'll have to put another school there. But here's a question. I don't know the answer to this. Why are there so many public schools in Bedford? Seven or more. You don't need that many public schools in a town this size. I bet if you live here, you can't sleep for all the screams of boys getting thrashed in initiation ceremony. So Bedford School, which we're in right now, has a chapel choir, it has these beautiful lawns, but it had a fire that burnt down the main building in 1979. But because this is a public school, the school brochure says, the dramatic event is known as the Great Fire. Of course it is, because this isn't just some chavvy comprehensive that just has a normal fire. Here, the fire ends up as a painting in the Louvre, and the poet laureate was commissioned to write a poem about it that went, ashes swirl in Bedford skies, decades shrunk to smithereens, flames head west and no surprise, they end up swiped by Milton Keynes. I went round Bedford School, where we are now, and it's marvellous. I mean, we went into this one hall and he said this was specially designed with perfect acoustics for orchestral music. Which, to be fair, was much the same at my school. There was one hall, in fact, where some kids put all the windows in, and I'm sure it's because the acoustics were bad for a Debussy concert. And then there's this page about school trips on the school website that boasts, in 2016, the geography class went to Iceland. The Spanish club went to Seville. There was a ski trip to Austria. The rowers went to Switzerland, and the art class went to the Higgins Museum in Bedford. One subject the Bedford schools are particularly known for is geography, because all the lesson is taken up with students asking, are we in the East Midlands? Does anyone work at the school? And so with the sport then, who's done well at sport from Bedford? Must be loads, isn't it? Alistair Cook, yeah. Oh, was Monty Panesar here, was he? Eddie the Eagle? Oh, Paula Radcliffe went here, did she? She went to the state school.
Yeah. That's why she pissed in the street.
Very good. There's a massive history, of course, to Bedford, because this was, at one point, a centre of radicalism. John Bunyan, the dissenter who wrote Pilgrim's Progress after the Civil War, he came from Bedford. And you're so proud of this fact that someone from the town sent me a message on Twitter that went, and that's the last time there was progress of any sort in Bedford. So Bunyan became a preacher, but he believed that the common person could be in touch with God as much as the gentry. And so after the Civil War, when the king was restored to the throne, this was considered a bit racy, and Bunyan was jailed along with the Quakers. Or, as it puts it in the John Bunyan Museum, Bunyan was a soldier, preacher and dissenter, spending a whopping 12 years in Bedford prison for illegal preaching! Exclamation mark. I thought, is that written by someone who usually does carpet adverts? If it's jailbird you're looking for, we got just the thing in Bedford with John Bunyan on offer with a whopping 12 years in prison. Did you say 12? That's right, 12. And there's more. But there's a more recent part of Bedford's history here that is obvious all round the town, because after the war, the Bedford Brickworks needed hundreds of labourers. So they went to Naples and they put up adverts all round the city appealing for Italians to come here. And thousands of Italians came here to work. Mostly they came because they were sick of living in a place where everybody knew where it was. And so And this means Bedford apparently now has the biggest percentage of Italians in the population of any town in Britain. And as a result, Bedford Council's website claims, after New York and London, Bedford is the most diverse city in the world. Which sounds a little bit unlikely until we remember that anyone who's lived here 20 minutes is counted as coming from Bedford. So, there were two Italian churches, there was an Italian vice consulate, dozens of Italian cafes where you meet people like Libby, who we're going to be talking to in a minute, who runs the coffee bar in the piazza. And it's brilliant talking to Libby because he's so Italian and so Bedford. What I love about the Italians here, they still talk like Italians but without the accent. So this is Bedford, it's the motherland, you understand. You want good cappuccino, you don't go to New York, you come to Bedford. They bring us here because we know how to make bricks. You never see a crooked Italian brick, maybe from Milan, but not from Naples. Gary Baldy, he come here, 1860, he'd know one day we all follow. He say, I fought a war to unite Italy, now I try to unite Bedfordshire, but Luton, they're not interested. Many Italians, they come from Bedford. Leonardo da Vinci, he come from Bedford. I read it on famous people from Bedford website. Verdi, you know, he composed the beautiful opera. He write magical arias of a boy and a girl from each side of the river. They are so much in love, but they can never meet because the bridge, it doesn't go all the way across. Right, Libby. Libby, so, what else happens then that's Italian that makes you think, God, this wouldn't happen if there weren't all the Italians in?
Oh, if Italy wins the World Cup. Which has happened a couple of times, you know.
Yeah. And what happens when England wins the World Cup?
Well, it was in black and white at the time. Yeah. I don't know.
And one thing you were telling us a little bit about was about your father when he had a passport.
Yes, well, no, he had the alien card. Which
an
like
alien that. Card?
Yeah, it had alien written on it, like, you know. Green, let's call it a passport. I always wanted to, like, keep this, but, one day I went home and it wasn't there anymore. And I asked him where it was. He goes, you don't need it anymore. We've got this now. And he took out the European passport.
Oh, right, thought, oh. So that's all gone well.
Yeah, that's gone really well, yeah, that's right. And I thought,
Nice. Well, I hope he's kept his alien card.
Yeah.
What I loved when I first met Libby, because Carl, the producer here, used to be an ice cream man, and it was such a beautiful moment, because the two of you... You know,
Capogiani machine's the best, yeah. And he's got one.
Yeah.
It's like the Ferrari of... you're not impressed, are you? It is. No, if anybody knows about ice cream machines, it's the Capogiani one, because it gives you a lot of air. It gives you a lot of air. So when you guys get ice creams, have a look out. Like, if it's a thick one, then they're not making a lot of money, all right?
Oh, so that's why you're impressed with this machine.
Right,
it's brilliant. You only need fourpence worth of ice cream to last a year.
That's it. Yeah.
Because you've been here so long now, it's sort of second, third generation, I suppose, then it all's really mixed in then, isn't it?
Yeah, well, everybody's mixed in. We're part of Bedford, part of Great Britain, really. Like my son here.
What's your name?
I'm Joseph.
He's English-Italian.
So who would you support if England would play in Italy?
Oh. I put the rugby on.
Yeah. You've raised him well. OK, thanks. Libby and Joseph, they've been brilliant.
Thank you very much.
When the Italians first came here, they were given short contracts, had to live in the old army huts, but those who stayed eventually did bring their families, and now there are lots of Italian shops here. Conte di Savoia, Italian tailors, makers of fine bespoke Italian suits, boasts on its website, Conte di Savoia earns another 5-star review. Well, of course it does. Who's going to give an Italian tailor a bad review? And there was one guy once, he only gave us 3 stars. You don't see him around there anymore. I went to an Italian club to get a sense of the excitement and glamour of the Italian community in Bedford. And in a way I did, because the car park was absolutely full and I got to the door and I could see all this stuff going on in a back room, and one man came to the door and said, "We're shut." And I really wanted him to say, "Take a hike, sonny, you ain't seen nothing going on." And there was a red splattered stain on the doorstep. There really was. I mean, I'm not saying anything. It could well have been red wine, a certain sort of red wine that has hair and a tooth in it. It could have... But it's right that this club had lots more going on than I could see, because it's Bedford, and you make everything like that here. There's a magazine here for the Italian community, by the way, called Controversy. Oh, I'm not going to do that. That's too rude. There's a magazine here for the Italian community that caused controversy because it published a story that went, a report has revealed Italian men should date East European women because they are willing to let their man rule and forgive cheating. But to be fair, if they're cheating on their wives, they're only trying to integrate into the customs of the local community. I told you. But nothing that happens here in this secret place with too much education is as beautifully seductive as the history of the wonderful Panacea Society. This is the cult that involved hundreds of people who set up a commune in Albany Street because they believed the Garden of Eden was in Bedford. Bless them. Now, several people have said to me here, when I've expressed a hint of doubt about this claim, it is a very pretty spot. And I accept that does pretty much clear up any lingering concern. Now, the Panacea Society's belief came from the verse in the book of Genesis that goes, the Lord God planted a garden in Eden, and there he put the man he had formed and made trees grow out of the ground, and it was good, for the garden was in the east, though not really in the east. And it's true, because when God said, let there be light, he clearly meant the reflection from the Moat House Hotel. The Ark was obviously the airship out at Cardington, and the prodigal son was clearly from Bedford because he cleared off at the age of four and hasn't yet been back. Now, I'm going to be speaking over the next few minutes to Gemma, if Gemma's about.
She couldn't make it.
Oh, okay then. Well, I was going to ask a serious scientific question if anybody does know the answer. Why is the Garden of Eden in Bedford?
It's handy for the M1.
It's handy for the M1. It's handy for the M1, yeah. Eve?
Yes, love? I've got to go to Leicester. The snake's not well.
The wonderful part of the Panacea Society is that this, so far, is the sensible bit. Because... I might as well, she's not here. Because they believed in the holiness of a woman preacher called Joanna Southcott, who announced in the 1800s that at the age of 64 she was pregnant with a second Messiah sent by God. Now, Joanna Southcott built up a mass following in the 1790s, but she then died and it was revealed that she hadn't been pregnant at all. Now, you can see why her followers were fooled. If a 64-year-old stomach swells up, the most likely explanation is that she's pregnant with the Messiah. Who could guess it was some sort of illness? Some followers announced that she'd given birth, but to a gassy spirit that you couldn't see. I wish I was making this up. Joanna Southcott also left piles of writing that she called her prophecies, and one member of the Panacea Society said in an interview, the writings are fascinating. She logs the conversation she has with the devil, and it's awful because the devil's so rude. That's shocking, isn't it? I mean, it's one thing being the Prince of Darkness. There's no need to forget your manners, is there? I suppose the conversation went, I want your soul. What's the magic word? Please. That's better. Now, this next bit gets complicated. Joanna Southcott prophesied that there would be more prophets and then Jesus would return. And in 1919, a vicar's daughter called Mabel Bartrop announced that she was the final prophet predicted, whose real prophet name was Octavia. And she would prepare for the return of Jesus, because Joanna Southcott's prophecies were believed to contain the secrets of heaven on earth. But they were locked in a large wooden box, which Mabel, also called Octavia, said could only be opened if 24 leading bishops were present. But sadly, no bishops were interested. I bet they'd have done it if it was hosted by Noel Edmonds. Now, to be fair to Mabel, shortly after announcing she was a prophet, she booked herself into a mental hospital for 18 months. But this didn't deter her followers. At one point, there were 70 people living in the commune at Albany Road, and when Mabel returned from the asylum, according to her biography, she came to believe that if she went 77 steps from her house, Satan would attack her. This meant that from 1918 until her death in 1934, she was virtually a prisoner in her own house. Now, I don't wish to be scornful about anyone's faith, but as messiahs go, that doesn't put her up with the best, does it? She always hoped that she'd be able to overcome this affliction and be able to travel a mile and a half so that at least she could get her own provisions. But none of her disciples had the heart to tell her that this wouldn't help, as all the shops had been swiped by Milton Keynes. In 1923, the Panacea Society decided it wasn't eccentric enough, and Mabel or Octavia issued a decree that she had the capacity to heal any illness by getting the patient to drink tap water that she'd breathed on. And her biography says, her followers would drink the water and apply it to their bodies, but it was cumbersome to transport the water to followers who lived far away in places like Cornwall. So the solution was to cut great rolls of linen into tiny squares, which Octavia would breathe on, and then send them in the post to the sick. And these are the only people from Bedford of any note who've bothered to stay. But whatever your opinion about divine breath, the Panacea Society was shrewd. They bought property in Bedford, which is now worth tens of millions, which is now part of a trust that funds groups around the town, and they even have one house called the Ark, which was left empty for years because it was being saved for Jesus when he comes back. Even the problems that you have here in Bedford wouldn't trouble Jesus. A bridge that doesn't go all the way across, that's not going to bother him, is it? Amongst the many things written about the society, do we know if they had their own prayers? I think they did. I think this is one of their own prayers. Give me strength through deed and prayer to praise the Lord who art in heaven. Let me hope the steps to there are no more than 77. Shame that I came from the Panacea Society.
More than 77 steps away.
One reason that Jesus may well come to Bedford when he returns is for a Bedfordshire clanger. And, do we still have Bedfordshire clangers?
Yes.
This is a sort of pasty. Traditional clanger recipes are to have beef up one end with rhubarb and custard, that sort of thing. Is that... Libby, do you sell them or are they...
Only during festivals, but...
All right, do you just get a little bit of a clanger then pump it full of air? Now, also, other things I found out, I do know this, some mothers do have them. The TV show in which Frank Spencer broke everything was filmed in Bedford. Yeah. One famous episode filmed here was when he was put in charge of building a bridge. As your engineering has been so successful, you've been put in charge of building something simple like an airship. The airship went over today. Did everyone see the airship? These are made and stored in these massive hangars in a place called Cardington, and they're 300 feet long, these airships, and they are the longest aircraft currently in the world. So, do we know who one of the main investors in the airships was?
Bruce Dickinson.
Bruce Dickinson, of Iron Maiden?
Yes.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Everybody knows that. Bruce Dickinson. But they look fantastic. I was allowed into the field where the airship bobbles about on the grass, and it's just ridiculously huge. And no one can travel in the actual airship bit. I'm so daft, right, because I thought, oh, do people all cram into there? But you can't, because it's all full of helium. It would be terrible if that leaked out. It's not only would there be a disaster, but the pilots have no dignity at all.
Mayday, mayday, mayday!
This isn't just a new fad. Airships have been travelling from here since the 1920s. The famous R101 that crashed in Paris set off from here. Oh, which makes me think, you're a bloody jinx, Bedford. I'm not getting on anything that sets off from here. I'm uneasy about getting on the Thames Link. It's no wonder they put the airport in Luton, is it? You played an important part in the military here, Bedford. During the war, the BBC Symphony Orchestra was evacuated to here, to the Corn Exchange, in secret. And so every night on the radio, after a performance, an announcer said, "This is the BBC Symphony Orchestra coming from somewhere in England." Lovely. And it was assumed that this was said to keep the location secret, though it was recently revealed it was because... It's the best description of where Bedford actually is. And And you've come up with a whole new way to transform the economy by introducing a whole new tax called the Bedford Bid, a special levy that businesses have to pay that goes towards making Bedford attractive to visitors. Whose idea was it to set up a protection racket in a place already full of Italians? Product paid for by the bid is these people who wander around with blue hats helping out visitors, giving answers to their queries, such as, I'm sorry, we don't have a Debenhams, you'll have to go to Milton Keynes. That's... Oh, yeah, you have got a Debenhams.
It might have gone by now.
I think, in fact, you actually like most people not really knowing where Bedford is, because then they can't come here and spoil it. I think there's a bit of that. You don't like people knowing it's here. When the kids come here to board at the private schools, they probably get dropped off at Leighton Buzzard and then they're blindfolded, put in a car and brought in the boot so they can't tell anyone where it is. And there's a big immigrant population here with no apparent tension and everybody gets along. You don't want that getting out. That puts you at odds with the whole direction of the Western world. Nelson Mandela came here to commemorate his friend Trevor Huddleston. I bet you had to keep that quiet. When he said to my good friend Trevor, who spent many years in Bedford, you went, shh, no one tell him he left when he was five. This bloke spent 5.5 times as long in prison as he lived here. And if you want to keep secrets, it doesn't hurt that a fifth of the population is Italian, does it? I can't say. I don't know. Maybe it was. Maybe it was. The whole town feels like you walk through doors and then suddenly go, wow, I didn't realise all this was in here. You come into a home counties town, there are thousands of Italians. You walk into a shed, there's an airship. You go through a school gate and there's a planetarium and the Elgin marbles. You stroll down a suburban road, there's the Garden of Eden and a house for Jesus. So I'll leave you, Bedford, with the words of your most famous product, John Bunyan, who actually did stay here, albeit because he had no choice as he was in prison for a whopping 12 years. And this section of Pilgrim's Progress, which many believed was inspired by his times in this very splendid secret town. Christian sat by the grass as Mr. Worldly Wiseman promised to teach him the lessons of how to reach the land of morality. You must learn fortitude and valour, he said, while gazing in the direction of Mr. Feeblemind, and I can teach you such disciplines. It will cost £6,000 a term, but the... but the good news is we do a lot of rowing. Near nightfall, he was assailed by a young farmer who spoke of life in morality. And when Christian contemplated his destiny, he became aware of a time when he would find morality. It would lay close to strength, but not really in strength, more sort of in courage, but not really courage either. You know, wisdom, we're not really there.
Mike Steele nella nostra città è stato performed by Mike Steele con materiali di Pete Sinclair, è prodotto in Bedford da Carlo Cooper, è stato una BBC Studios produzione. Parabéns.
Thank you very much, Bedford.
Matlock or Matlock Bath?
Ooh. Definitely Matlock.
Matlock Bath every time.
It's just different.
Matlock is better because it doesn't pretend to have a seaside.
You also have all that really fun seaside stuff in the middle of the country.
It's a bit Blackpool, isn't it? It's lovely.
Ayot me dock.
Everyone calls each other dock, so it's weird, you know.
Ayot me dock.
Worst thing about Matlock Bath are the preponderance of chip shops, unfortunately. Very little else. Chip shops and...
The seagulls. The worst thing is the seagulls.
It's a bit behind the times, isn't it?
Mark Steele's in town.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. Welcome to Mark Steele's in town, which this week comes from the beautiful Derbyshire town of Matlock Bath. A town so secure about its identity, it proudly sells itself to tourists as a seaside resort, even though it's 120 miles from the sea. When you first get here, you just can't help noticing that the entire high street is made up of amusement arcades, fish and chip shops, and is designed to look like a seafront. And it works, because the only seaside thing you don't have is a sea. And I've always thought the presence of a sea is overrated in deciding whether somewhere's by the sea. Lots of people here make the boast that Matlock Bath has the longest inland promenade in Britain, which is true, because a promenade is something you have at the sea. And nowhere else inland is mental enough to believe they're at the sea. If you wanted, you could also have the tallest inland lighthouse, the busiest inland coast guard, and the widest ferry port at a place where there's no water. Because this is the only town with a personality disorder called delusional inland seaside by proxy syndrome. When you see someone come in from Chesterfield, you all go, all hands on deck, there be pirates. And make them walk the plank and land on some grass. I bet psychotherapists here have to sit you all down every now and again and say, can you describe to me, Matlock, what happens to you in the moments before you hear the waves crashing onto the front by the lead mining museum? So, this isn't so much of a show, it's an intervention. And maybe the first thing you should do as part of your recovery is start thinking of your promenade as more of a road. To be fair, you've got more than a sea that's a bit on the dry side here. You've also got the famous cable cars, of course, that go up to the heights of Abraham. And when you see the terrain that leads up to the top there, you can't help but look at those cable cars and think, you lazy bastard. It's not that much of a hill. The cable cars were installed in 1984 to boost the tourism trade as word was getting around that there isn't really a sea. So, now, luckily, the town planners were aware that the important thing with the tourist attraction is to make it easily accessible, which is why to get to the cable car, all you have to do is walk to the edge of the railway platform, across a track, go behind a fence, go up a muddy bank, through some puddles, round another fence, walk through a forest, and there you are. You can wait for the cable car that takes you back across the place where you started. Have you all been up here? It's fun, isn't it? I love it, especially the bit where it stops for a few minutes and leaves you dangling over the A6. I'm particularly fond of the quote of the first people from Matlock Bath to go up in the cable car who said, and I quote, "You can see for miles up here, across to Snitterton and west out towards Buxton, across the full breadth of the Derwent Valley." Hang on, there's no sea. They've been lying to us. Now, it is possible that the cable car was put here after someone read a book called Nooks and Corners of Derbyshire, which I think I've got somewhere, that says, "One of the greatest attractions of Matlock Bath is the wooded slopes called the Heights of Abraham and the gigantic mountain towering above it." Gigantic mountain! Oh, it's terrible in Matlock in the summer. You can't move for Sherpas. We set off on day one from the base camp at the station car park. We took a final glance back at the comforts that we were leaving behind, going into battle with a gigantic mountain, knowing that we wouldn't reach the summit for 15 minutes. The Heights of Abraham had a huge impact on so many people, including the poet Lord Byron came to Matlock. And it was Byron who called the town Little Switzerland. And he wrote a poem as well, explaining this description. "To Matlock, sir, a place so grand you never more shall frown. I call it Little Switzerland. Go there to get put down." Now, marvellously, not only is there a cable car, but there was a tramway built in the 1890s that just went up the Bank Road, I think it was called at the time, and back, because you don't like walking up a hill, do you? So it was tuppence to go up, a penny to come back down. According to the pamphlet called Tuppence Up, Penny Down, the tram was slow. You could get off, buy a packet of cigarettes, catch it up and get back on again. And it was modelled, apparently, on the tram system in San Francisco. You're not lacking in self-esteem, Matt. But here's something that is true. There's a mineral that you get here in Matlock that is yours. So much so that it's been named after you, a mineral called matlockite. And some geologists claim that it has a similar effect as kryptonite does with Superman and takes away your powers, in your case, the ability to walk up a hill. So many other attractions here. On Twitter, there's a man called James Nichols who wrote, "The man in the general store at Matlock Bath gets arsey if you ask for change for the station car park." Even if you buy a Snickers Duo off him. Do you know that bloke? There are brilliant shops here, though, of course, especially in Matlock Bath, little seasidey shops. There's a 1940s cafe called Pudding on the Ritz, and it, which is lovely, and it says on the board outside, "Step back into the 1940s, authentic 1940s cafe, free Wi-Fi." I was hoping to make a cake with some of me powdered egg, and no mistake, but I couldn't get the recipe because the blooming broadband was down. One of the delights of Matlock Bath is, of course, the wonderfully varied cuisine on offer. Now, usually, when you go to a town, you face the disappointment, I think, of finding a fish and chip shop and seeing that the shop next door to the fish and chip shop sells other things, such as clothes or vegetables. But here, if you accidentally walk 5 paces past the fish and chip shop and still fancy fish and chips, instead of having to walk back, there will be another fish and chip shop. And the names of the fish and chip shops are marvellous as well in Matlock. There's Promenade Fish Bar, Taste of the Waves. Taste of those Matlock waves. I expect when the wind's right, you all get up at 5 in the morning for an early bit of surfing, do you, on the River Derwent? I bet it's like California in 1970 at the back of the disused basketball court. But it gets packed here on a bank holiday. You know, it's just rammed. I honestly can't work out where everyone's going. Thousands of people. Are they all going to the amusement arcade? I'm afraid we're fully booked at the moment, sir. There should be a space available on the push-a-coin-off-the-ledge machine in about 20 minutes, if you care to wait, sir. And apparently, of course, the man who owns the amusement arcades there is a millionaire. The only trouble is, all his money's in 2p's. I'll buy a speedboat. How much is it? £80,000, sir. Right, here you are. Ching, 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 ching. There's £1. The next issue is to emphasise how important it is not to mix up your Matlocks. So we're in Matlock Bath at the moment, not Matlock, which is an entirely different place. That's a whole 9 metres away. Or to use the local language, 30 nautical feet. So which Matlock is everybody from? We need to find this out. How many people from Matlock? Yay! And some from Matlock Bath?
Yay!
And Matlock Dale? Matlock Green. Oh, I'd missed that one. It's flat. I bet you look at it with envy, don't you? No, I can see why you have to call all the different bits of Matlock different names, because otherwise it's just a huge, overwhelming metropolis. You wouldn't know where you were unless you were able to break it down into its separate individual Matlocks. But you've only got to walk past a tree here and you suddenly find yourself in a different village if you're not familiar. And you get told things, you find yourself in a pub or something, someone going, "Take my advice and don't go past second tree after the footpath because that's Snitterton. They've got a river and a hall and you can't trust that. And don't go to Lower Lumsdale, their sheep are poisonous from the waterfall. Now, 8 inches in that direction is Farley. And then you've got Worksworth, they're bonkers even by Matlock standards. Cromford's a rat race, and there's over 9 people live there. I don't trust it. That side of the road is Matlock Bank. Whatever you do, don't get it mixed up with Matlock Bath. And past that ditch is Bonsall. Nothing ever happens there except spaceships hovering over it full of airlines. To be fair, Bonsall was the subject of quite a discussion on TripAdvisor about whether it was a good place to stay if you were planning walks around the Peak District. And one reply from Bonsall was, "Whether Bonsall would be a good place to stay for walks depends, I think, on whereabouts in the Peak District you want to walk." That's the way to sell yourself. "Hello, we're thinking of stopping in your village of Bonsall. Is it a good spot for walking?" "It's all right if you want to walk round Bonsall. If you you want to walk around Snitterton, you're better off staying in Snitterton. You know. Now, who's from Wirksworth, then? There was a few from Wirksworth. I asked, because a man called Anthony... Is Anthony here?
Yep.
Oh, hello, Anthony. Because a man called Anthony requested that we do the whole show from Wirksworth, right? And we had this brilliant little exchange. And it did endear me to the place, because to start with, he wrote, we've got Janet Rager lingerie and tape for lawyers' briefs made at Harlem Mill, Eccesbourne Railway, Adam Bede car sales. And I mean, it's a wonder there haven't been several shows written about Adam Bede car sales of Wirksworth. It went on Carsingham Reservoir Beauty Spot, Book Festival, a beer festival, Northern Lights Cinema, which is tiny, and an international marmalade festival. So I wrote to say, thanks very much, but we're already doing Matlock. And Anthony replied, you're lost then, as I just won a medal at the International Marmalade Festival. Surprisingly, Anthony didn't mention the National Stone Centre, which I suppose maybe comes just outside your domain, is it? Yeah. The National Stone Centre. Now, I'm not proud of this, but I was honestly really excited about going to the National Stone Centre. Because I thought, where else can you see an array of stones? I thought there'd be like, what's going to be there? There'll be a hexagonal stone and stones that have won the World Skimming Championships. Maybe a replica of the stone that David used to slay Goliath. And you pass all these country houses on the way made entirely of stone. And then you get to the National Stone Centre and it's a prefab building made entirely of plastic. The only construction for miles and miles that isn't made of stone, and inside there are some pictures of stones and a cafe and not a single stone! Not one in the National Stone Centre! And I said to the woman who works there, I don't mean to be rude, but there are no stones here. And she said, yes, everybody who comes here makes the same complaint. But Bonsall is even more adventurous, as they organise the World Hen Racing Championships. And they organise days, and I promise this is true, where people bet on which part of a field a cow does a dump. And, and instead of being quietly ashamed of this, like people who can't stop stealing things, they boast about it as if it reflects well on them. And now we're very honoured here to have Lynn. Where's Lynn? So, Lynn, first of all, tell me about the hen racing.
The hen racing came about because the pub landlord who was new to the area was trying to find things to entertain people, and it was annoying one of the locals a bit, so the local spun him a story about this historical event called hen racing that he could reinvent and relaunch. But it was all a wind-up.
Right, because hens aren't known for their ability to...
So he started the hen races, and it's now a global event. Television companies come from all over the world to film the hen races.
What, is it like Sky Sports 3 or something? Are they away first time?
Pretty
and they're
much.
All going in different directions! But everyone goes up there and takes part in this then?
Yeah, it's a very popular thing. Actually, my friend Trevor's got a really good story about hen racing.
Oh, right. Yeah, lovely. No,
I'm the only human being ever to have entered the hen races. Now, this would be...
You're not going to get disqualified in retrospect like these people.
Well, this was before the international rules were set, so, you know, it was fairly easy for me to enter at this point in time.
Yeah.
I dressed up as a chicken. The hardest part was finding the red tights, because the colour's essential in these kind of things, you know.
Yeah.
And I lined up with the hens. Hens aren't good at racing starts, so when you get in the crouching position...
Right.
..you've always got a head start.
Right. I'm just thinking of how rapidly the property prices are falling. This is by no means all of Bonsall, because it's also known as one of the best places in Britain to see flying saucers. Now, some people of a sceptical frame of mind might wonder why it is that aliens that can cross a universe would choose a village by Matlock to hover over, but one leading astronomer from Jodrell Bank suggested... From signals received through radio telescopes that analyse fluctuations in matter displacement in the areas around Matlock affected by unusually high cosmic activity, the aliens are saying, keep looking, there must be a sea there somewhere. Uh, Maybe the spacemen go on AliensNet and ask, like, is Bonsall a good place for our spaceship to hover? It depends where in the Peak District you're thinking of invading. And there's a lot more to Matlock and Matlock Bath than its irrational seaside town image, we know that. It grew as a town originally through its thoroughly rational claim that its water had magical healing properties. The spa here was first discovered in the 1690s. The water in Matlock Bath cured you if you drank it, whereas the water in Matlock Bank only healed you if you bathed in it. And the other natural substance here that made Matlock valuable was, of course, lead. And this is handy because nothing ensures that local water is especially healthy as much as huge dollops of lead falling out. And so there is a lead museum, which is right in this very building that we're in, and it's fascinating, the lead museum. Not a single bit of lead, of course, but there's a book I've got there called A History of the Matlocks, and it quotes a traveller from 1732 who says, "There are no inhabitants in the town except those who dig for lead ore, although one morning I did see a woman naked. She laughed and said, 'Oh, nobody takes notice of this sort of thing here.'" Foxy than you let on, Matlock. Although, to be fair, she probably was on the way to the nudist beach. In the 1860s, the first hydrotherapy centre was opened. And one method that the hydro centres used for cleansing the body was smearing it with chilies. The book Tuppence Up a Penny Down says, "Chili paste would be rubbed on various parts of the body and was excellent in helping patients to forget aches and pains." To be fair, the water that you drank from a Matlock hydrotherapy centre did have an impact on the visitor's health, because many customers developed a huge disfiguring growth on their neck that became known as Derbyshire neck. And this is a thyroid condition that leads to these lumps, and it may even have been caused by some of the treatments at the centres. So how many other tourist towns can boast a whole disease named after them like that? It must have been like going away and getting a tannies now. You'd go into work with a hideously deformed neck and people would go, "Ooh, someone's been on holiday." And you've also got caves here, of course, and they've been another attraction since Victorian times. In the 1950s, you know, that I was amazed, in the 1950s, 500 people lived in the caves, calling themselves troglodytes, until there was a meeting in the town that agreed to ban them from all the local pubs. And in an unexpected turn of events, some of the cave dwellers were then converted by the local Jehovah's Witnesses. Of course they got converted. Caves don't have a door on it, do they? Just come straight in. There was the time in 1913 when animals were added as an attraction to Lover's Walk, but they escaped, including wolves. And the problem with the bears was no one realised how big they would become. It's such a charming innocence. You've got a delightful history with animals here. The Gem of England tells us, in the 1930s, the council held a rat week every year to encourage householders to exterminate their rats. Now, this is something else unique about Matlock, that they had to be encouraged to get rid of them. I suppose you all thought, there's bound to be rats. They come in on the ships. The book goes on to say, I swear it says this, "This did not look good for a health resort." So it's endearing, though, Matlock. It's like the Beast of Ryber. You're familiar with the Beast of Ryber? That's supposed to live round here, because Smedley, who owned one of the first hydrotherapy centres, had a mansion built on top of the hill at Ryber called Smedley's Folly. And after he died, the mansion was turned into a zoo. And the zoo ran into problems when the cages all broke, because no one had anticipated that any of the baby animals would would get bigger. After John Smedley died, the zoo was shut down, and then there were reports of the beast. And according to Wikipedia, the Beast of Ryber is an alleged wild animal that may live round the hamlet of Ryber near Matlock. Some believe it to be a phantom wild cat, like the Beast of Bodmin, while others contest that it's a fox. It's brilliant. It's imagination again. Has anyone seen the beast?
My chickens have suffered from it.
Your chickens, have they?
Yeah.
How many chickens did you have?
I did have six.
All right. Are you sure that they were all done in by the beast, or was one of them rather tall and went off running in a race? there's every sort of creature here. You've got an aquarium, which advertises itself with the slogan, come and see our famous carp collection. But, God, I think, isn't that a bit dangerous? That one of the only buildings in the town that isn't a fish and chip shop is an aquarium. Only got to have one of the chippies go a bit short one day. Because there's been a poor haul from the trawlermen round the Cape of Cromford. and there's a petrifying well. It's brilliant, the aquarium, isn't it? The well is full of thermal water and minerals that make anything in there look as if it's turned to stone. And next to the well, there's a notice that tells you how people would be fascinated to watch this happen. And it must have been so exciting to watch objects petrify in front of your very eyes over a period of 40 years. but the main attraction was always the environment, and you were rightly proud of it. So there were poems such as this one by a man called J. Montgomery that went, great nature, slumbering by fair Derwent's stream, conceived these giant mountains in a dream. And my favourite review of this poem was the one that went, it's not a giant mountain! If any of you ever go to the Andes, you'll go, bloody hell! These must have been bought as gentle inclines, but no one realised they'd get bigger. And you've got illuminations, Matt. Yay! The Venetian Boat Builders Association put lights over their boats and sailed down the river, all lit up, causing the local tourist website to declare, move over Blackpool, this is how we do illuminations in Derbyshire. Yeah. What does Blackpool know about illuminations? Is that not much of a day out going up there, is it? And when the tide's out up there, it could be a 10-minute walk to the sea, not like here. Excited. It's a brilliantly exciting place. You don't know, you're not restricted by the normal rules here. You've even got a Gulliver's Kingdom. Now, this is a leisure park with rides. There's a roller coaster. There's a swinging pirate ship thing there and a log flume. And in most towns, it'd be a treat for kids. But in Matlock, I bet you all go, oh, it's a pirate ship. And we can go up it and you can see Australia. I love it there. I mean, one or two of the rides I was surprised with because I wasn't sure that these things actually are part of Gulliver's Travels. there's a JCB zone. Did that play a big part in the book? I also love the little signs on boards dotted around Matlock to tell you about the history, such as how this was the setting for the world's first factory. But my favourite is the one that says, as the Earth was forming 330 million years ago, this area was the coast. This explains it. 330 million years ago, day trippers would sit on the promenade eating fresh fish caught that afternoon in Snitterton, listening to the waves gently lapping up the A6. But time is irrelevant here. You're not slaves to fashion. Your shops look like they should be in the 1970s. Your buildings are Victorian. Your origins as a town comes from the spas of the 1700s. And your identity as a seaside town comes from 330 million BC. The first factory was round here, created by Richard Arkwright, who invented his spinning machine. And that's a sign of your ambition, Matlock. Not only were you ahead of the times with the first factory, but already you were trying to start the Industrial Revolution to create global warming to make the tide levels rise. And then before you know it, wallop, and you're back by the sea again. It's a little beacon of childish innocence here. Ooh, let's get in the cable car and look round the caves and pretend we're on a mountain. We've got a sea. And you want to go, yes, Matlock, you have. Bless. And I will leave you, Matlock, with the words of someone else who understood the playfulness of your town, because Jonathan Swift, whose famous book Gulliver's Travels has given its name to your leisure park, is said by some to have been inspired, in part at least, by the very town of Matlock. And I'll leave you with this. Thank you very much. Lemuel Gulliver woke amidst the debris of his shipwrecked vessel, pondering where on the globe he might have landed. I've arrived at a stretch of land adjacent to the roughest of seas, he thought. I'm probably in Matlock. Gingerly, he removed a dripping sock and placed it on the ground, which was when he heard the voice of a Lilliputian cry, "Good God, it's gigantic!" We would surely never be able to climb to the top of that without a cable car. As Gulliver lit a cigarette, the little people surrounded him, screaming, "Such light! It is surely far superior to any illuminations they have at Blackpool." Gulliver's observations took him to the world these little folk had created. He saw a vast and complex city lay before him, comprising fish and chip shop after fish and chip shop, heading off yonder and away, way, way unto the horizon, a full 9 metres away, in a place called Lilliput Bath. Thank you very much.
Mark Steele's In Town was written and performed by Mark Steele,
with additional material by Pete Sinclair.
It was produced in Matlock Bath by Carl Cooper.
It was a BBC Studios production.
Thank you very much.
The best thing about Inverness is its compact size.
The best accent in the whole of Scotland. They say, "How you doing?"
"No bad, yourself?"
Inverness is famous for...
Well, I'm not going to say Loch Ness.
Loch Ness Monster?
I believe in the Loch Ness Monster because I've actually seen sight of it.
It's usually by the time you get halfway down the bottle of whiskey.
It's probably a log.
The worst thing...
The weather sometimes.
The wind.
Right, the daylight hours are great in the summer and they don't exist in the winter.
He says, "Have you seen the Loch Ness Monster?" I says, "Seen it. I was married to it for 25 years.
Well,
Mark Steele's In Town.
Thanks. Thank you very much, and welcome to Mark Steele's In Town, which this week comes from the tropical shores of Inverness. A paradise that's ideal to retire in, as some days in winter it stays light for nearly 4 minutes. But I should start properly, as it's Inverness, by saying, "Aye, aye, Inverness, how you doing?" Ah, you seen it, man. Because we're so far away from hectic life up here that you go through all that rather than just say hello to while away a few more seconds of your day. You must get a little bit cross with the sort of London image. The London people come up here now, and of course people get completely confused, because London people think of Inverness as just being like three cottages and a shepherd. And if there is a branch of PC World, that's run by a shepherd who goes, "Oh, a USB stick, you see. I'll get Macaulay to fetch one." And this must be annoying, the stupid English view of the Highlands, where you think of Inverness as full of nothing but tartan sweaters and malt whiskey, and Inverness is clearly about much, much more than that. And that's why the first shops as you cross the main bridge there are the tartan sweaters, the malt whiskey shop, a shop called Tartan Tweeds that advertises itself as the cheapest kilt hire, and all around are adverts telling tourists to experience Inverness by going on the Nessie Dolphin and Whiskey Tour. Because that pretty much covers everyday life in Inverness, doesn't it? You get up early in Inverness, you feed your dolphins, and you have a wee dram of malt and take a blurred photo of the monster that could be a stick, and that's your task done for the day. There are a few quaint customs to charm the outsider. For example, one online comment on a website advising tourists says, "Before you arrive, make sure you remove the indicators from your car to blend in with the locals." although you're lovely, charm, quaint little Inverness, you're also the capital of the Highlands. So to the rest of the Highlands, you're this huge city. You're like the corner shop for everyone within 200 miles. People from Stornoway get a jeep and a ferry and a donkey and a train to come and buy 300 toilet rolls and 1,000 Twixes and the newspapers for a year ago. Oh, Donald Trump, I see you got in. And this means you have a warm, grand sense of superiority as a major centre, even though if you were this size anywhere normal, you'd be a village. Travelling across the north of Scotland to get to Inverness isn't particularly difficult. For example, there's the case of Kay Yor, who lived in the lighthouse at Cape Roth, and her journey was written about on the BBC website. A woman who left her remote home in the